This is WGNS Action Line, talking with Rutherford County newsmakers about what matters most to you. Now, your host, Scott Walker.
Peyton Pruitt with us this morning from MMC. He is a nurse practitioner there. And you are in the gastroenterology department, and you're a nurse practitioner there. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on the show this morning.
So tell us a little bit about your background, because it is different than, I would say, a lot of the doctors and nurse practitioners there, because of the fact that you from birth were treated at MMC.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been with MMC from a provider standpoint for almost 3 years, but when you look at a lifetime of with MMC, I was born by an obstetrician that worked with MMC. My pediatrician is still at MMC, Dr. Humphrey. So 31 years later, he is still there. Incredible legacy from his perspective and his career. And then also my wife, her obstetrician is at MMC, her children's pediatrician are MMC. So truly been with MMC for a lifetime from a patient perspective, and now I'm also blessed to be there as a provider.
What is that like working with some of the folks who brought you into the world?
Sure, it's awesome. Get to see them in the hallway, get to pass by them, get to see patients that have been referred by them. So those full circle moments, and just I always appreciated the care. I was always confident in the care that I received from MMC, and it just encouraged me to pursue a career there as well.
So what made you want to go this direction with a career?
So I knew from a very early age that I wanted to go into healthcare of some sort. Wasn't entirely sure which direction that would go. I was led to nursing and then eventually to the nurse practitioner role. And I just really like to get to meet patients, get to help them through their healthcare journey, and to counsel them on various ways and they can promote their health to the fullest.
By the way, anybody listening, you can text us if you have any questions about MMC at 615-893-1450. So what are some of the biggest topics this time of year?
So a huge portion of what we're talking about right now is colorectal cancer awareness. The month of March, which, believe it or not, is coming up so soon. Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month is the month of March. And so a big push to encourage people to get screenings for colorectal cancer. And so we're talking about that a lot, have a big push from our perspective, because we want anyone who is age 45 years or older to be screened for colorectal cancer.
And what is the number one screening method?
Sure. Number one screening method is absolutely via colonoscopy. There are certainly other methods out there. Lots of methods are being advertised, but the number one screening tool is colonoscopy. It's number one for a couple of reasons. Those reasons are that it will visualize the inside of the colon, and so other testing could have false negatives or false positives, and you really just can't replace actually viewing the inside of the colon with a camera and a light. So it is the number one as far as accuracy, and also with that, it's also considered therapeutic in that we can remove polyps at the time of the colonoscopy. Any other screening modality is just going to say, hey, this person might have polyps. Colonoscopy will remove those polyps during the procedure. And so what that means is that those polyps are precancerous polyps. We are concerned that eventually they could turn into cancer, but during the colonoscopy, we'll completely remove those polyps. And the illustration that I always say is it's like taking a weed and pulling it out by the roots. When we remove that particular polyp, we remove that polyp's ability to ever turn into cancer because it's no longer in the colon. So it is the number one screening tool as far as accuracy, but also can remove polyps during the time of the procedure.
Well, I'm sure a lot of patients are fearful of colon cancer. There's, I'm sure, a number of other reasons why somebody may be having problems or symptoms that they probably Googled and came back as cancer, because every symptom in the world comes back as cancer, it seems
sure.
like on Google. But I'm sure there's a lot of other things that people end up having that are much less serious. So kind of ease the mind of listeners and tell us, what are some of those other things?
There's lots of things that can cause various GI symptoms. One thing that we always like to point out, the reason that we recommend screening at an early age of 45 or earlier based on family history or other risk factors, is that colon cancer, as far as a symptom, often if you're having symptoms of colon cancer, it's a late stage factor, right? So we want to start screening early before there's ever symptoms present, so we can go ahead and remove those polyps, get things done in an early fashion. That's what we want. not. We want to prevent cancer or catch it early. But from that perspective, if you are having symptoms, as I mentioned, there are an array of things and an array of tests that we are happy to perform. And if you ever have questions or think, should I be seen for this? I always say, if people think, should I be seen for this? The answer is yes. Go ahead and schedule an appointment. Reach out to our gastroenterology department. Talk to your primary care. And we are happy to see you and work through those symptoms and diagnose you with things that we can help you with or find the right answers for you.
When patients come in to see you, what are some of their concerns? What do they bring up to you?
Of course, colorectal cancer is one of them. Like you said, there's lots of Googling that can happen. People Google, they start getting concerned. But the most common symptoms that we see kind of across the board from a gastroenterology perspective, we see lots of nausea, vomiting. We see abdominal pain. We see bloating. We see blood per rectum or blood in the stool, things like that. And so all of those, depending on how they happen, the time frame of when they've happened, in conjunction with each other, there's an array of tests that we can perform. The nice thing about MMC at Westlawn is that is where the gastroenterology department is housed at Westlawn. And so we have kind of a full service department, if you will. Our clinic is housed at Westlawn. We have a radiology department at Westlawn, and we also have our colonoscopy, endoscopy, outpatient surgery center there at Westlawn as well. So once you come into the building at Westlawn from a gastroenterology perspective, we can take care of you from a clinic, imaging, and colonoscopy, endoscopy setting in one space. So we have lots of services that we can offer to further evaluate and investigate what's going on for you.
And I'm sure a lot of patients who come to you, first of all, they may feel awkward about it just because of the subjects that are talked about in the doctor's office, but they may feel awkward about it. But I'm sure they can rest assured because you guys see patient after patient after patient, many of whom have a lot of the same problems.
Sure. There is absolutely nothing at all to be embarrassed about or to feel awkward about. We have these conversations every single day. These conversations happen 15 to 18 times a day, depending on how many patients we're going to see per day. So don't be embarrassed about it. Don't feel awkward about it. I promise you're not going to make us uncomfortable as providers. Like I said, we hear it every single day. We are comfortable talking about it, and we want to have those quote unquote awkward or difficult conversations with you, because we don't want you to be, you know, suffering in silence, if you will. We want you to be able to talk about those things with us so that we can further help you and get to the bottom of your problems. That's the whole goal. So many times we see within gastroenterology that people are treating symptoms or they're just kind of putting a band-aid on it. But what we would really like to do for our patients is get to the source or the root of that problem, so that way we can manage the source and not just the symptoms.
Being here in Tennessee, our diet is not necessarily the best when compared to other parts of the country. A lot of fried foods and probably who knows how many sodas we drink each day, but all of this goes into play in our health daily. In fact, I guess the outcome of that could be everything from constipation to runny stools and of course weight gain. That's another one. But when you start talking about those things like constipation, is that a big problem with patients, and is there usually an easy fix?
Sure. Is it a common problem? Absolutely. Is it an easy fix? Kind of depends on presentation. It could be an easy fix. It could be a complex fix. And so that's what we'll work through with a patient based on the chronicity of their symptoms. How long have they had these symptoms? What have they done from a personal perspective at home to help these symptoms already? As you mentioned, that diet plays a huge role. Across the board, diet is going to play a huge role in your gastrointestinal health. There are certainly things to be said about fast food, processed foods, fried foods, things like that can certainly cause symptoms. I often, the slogan, if you will, or the motto or verbiage that I use with a lot of patients, that if we view food as medicine, medicine can help us, but medicine can also hurt us. And so food is the same way. Food can promote our health, but food can also be a detriment to our health as well. And that goes into what we're drinking as well, you know, trying to drink as much water as possible and avoiding things that are going to hurt our bodies. And of course, activity is a big thing as well. Walking, any type of aerobic exercise is going to promote your overall health, but it's also going to promote your gastrointestinal health. And thankfully, we're coming into those sunnier, warmer days, so hopefully we can get outside more in the coming days.
Things like, of course, walking every day, a better diet, those two things alone, then combine it with maybe better sleep practices. Those seem to cure or help out or prevent a lot of problems.
Absolutely. It seems, you know, we say that so often and almost feels cliche, but that's truly where we are. If we will be more cognizant about what we're putting in our bodies, really we could probably prevent a lot of the symptoms that we're having. So in medicine, you think about preventing and then treating, right? If we can prevent the symptoms or prevent conditions, it's so much easier to prevent them than it is to treat them. And so that's where we are across the board in medicine, is that we always want to prevent if we can at all. If we can prevent your symptoms by avoiding certain foods or drinks, then we absolutely want to prevent them. That kind of takes us right into that perspective looking at colorectal cancer as well. Our main goal from a colorectal cancer perspective is to prevent it. We would love to prevent colorectal cancer versus having to treat it. And that's why colonoscopies are so important, because polyps, which are those precancerous growths, if we can go in and starting at age 45 or younger based on risk factors, if we can go in with the colonoscopy, remove those polyps, the whole purpose of removing those polyps is to prevent colorectal cancer. We don't want to find cancer. We want to prevent it. So it's screening, in that we are screening for colorectal cancer, but ultimately our goal is to prevent it by removing those polyps, catching them early and getting rid of them before they ever have the opportunity to turn into cancer. Kind of the slogan there, or the phrase, is that not all polyps are cancerous, but all colon cancer is going to start off as a polyp. So we want to completely get rid of those polyps and prevent. So it's all about prevention, stopping it before it happens, keeping things out of our body before they cause issues.
Again, with us this morning in studio, we have Peyton Pruitt, a nurse practitioner at MMC, and we have a question here. And again, our number is 615-893-1450. This person says, I am 50 and I've never had a colonoscopy. Is it painful? I'm sure that's the number one question you get. Is it painful?
Sure. That is a great question. It's always a concern. Anytime someone's going to have any type of procedure, is it going to hurt? What's the recovery time? What is this overall picture going to look like? And so that's a great question. During the colonoscopy, we do use medications that fall within the conscious sedation category of anesthesia. So if you schedule a colonoscopy and you have a colonoscopy, there is an anesthesia provider in the room. So that anesthesia provider, the way I always describe it, is that you will not feel anything, see anything, or hear anything during the procedure. So you will be asleep for the procedure. So it's a pain-free experience as far as the colonoscopy itself. Sometimes when people wake up, they complain about a little bit of abdominal bloating or discomfort, but it's generally very, very minimal. Most of my patients, when I talk to them after colonoscopy, say, hey, I didn't feel anything at all when I woke up. I was a little groggy from the anesthesia, which is completely to be expected. Maybe a little bit of bloating or gas after the procedure, but it is very, very rare for anyone to complain of any pain. So we try to make it from start to finish a pain-free experience, if at all possible.
You have some folks who are afraid to be put under for any reason. Can you do a colonoscopy without being unconscious, if you would?
It is possible. We try not to do that, for the main reason is because there is some discomfort and uncomfort level with the colonoscopy itself based on the colonoscope kind of traveling through the colon. So in the past, they have offered that, but generally the colonoscopies had to end prematurely because the patient just couldn't tolerate it. And so then we weren't able to complete the exam. You've already prepped for the procedure. So once someone goes to a colonoscopy prep, they really want to be able to have that procedure, as would anyone, right? So generally what we say is that we recommend the anesthesia just to make you comfortable. Again, it is a mild version of anesthesia. It's not a true general anesthesia as you would see during a general surgery. There's no intubation, i.e. they don't put a breathing tube in. You're breathing on your own the whole time. So it's a very mild sedation. The medications that they use work quickly, but they also wear off very quickly. So within the hour after the procedure, generally people are coming not even groggy anymore. So you wake up very quickly after the procedure, and within the hour, most of the time people report their grogginess is even worn off within the hour. So it is possible, but that's a deeper conversation that we would have to have within clinic. But generally, we're going to recommend across the board to consider anesthesia to make sure you're comfortable.
I think I would choose to be asleep.
For sure. Absolutely. I would too.
Now, which location of MMC does this take place at?
Sure. That happens at the MMC at Westlawn. That is the newest building that we have right off of Veterans Parkway. So it's right there at the corner of 840 and Veterans Parkway, right beside the new Publix. That happens there on the first floor. We only have one entrance of that building. So I just tell everyone, when you walk in the doors, you take an immediate right. We have a very spacious waiting room, and that is where colonoscopies and endoscopies happen Monday through Friday. They happen in the morning and in the afternoon, Monday through Friday.
This next question says, I don't know if this is a gastro problem, but I recently got checked out by my heart doctor and everything is fine, but I have had pain just under my left rib for about 3 or 4 days now, and it feels like I pulled a muscle, but I don't know what type of doctor to see for it.
If it's right there within the epigastric or left upper quadrant or right upper quadrant, we would be happy to see him or her in clinic for further evaluation. There's various testing that we can do. The greatest thing to do is, if you have more questions and would like to be seen, mmclinic.com, or you can reach out directly to the gastroenterology office at 615-867-8070 to schedule an appointment, and we would be happy to further evaluate those symptoms.
What organs are even on the left side under?
So when you think about kind of the epigastric area, there's a several organs there that kind of, they don't layer on top of each other per se, but they're all in the same area. So within the epigastric area, you do have your stomach, your liver, your gallbladder, your pancreas. So all of those kind of lay there within the epigastric left upper quadrant, right upper quadrant area. The hard part about gastroenterology is what's called referred pain. So for example, if I fell down and hurt my wrist, I could point at my wrist and say it hurts right there, because I know exactly where it hurts. Oftentimes within the abdomen, those organs can have referred pain. So sometimes if someone's complaining of their gallbladder, they may have pain in their right shoulder. So it's hard to always say exactly what is the source of the pain just based on the location. But those are the organs right there in that general area.
And the gallbladder, that's one of those things they remove a lot out of folks.
They do, especially in the South. I think there's probably more in the South that gets removed. Again, that's based on diet. Those fatty, greasy, fried foods are going to be common culprits and common offenders of the gallbladder. Also, a certain level of comorbidities such as high cholesterol and various other illnesses can create a perfect condition for gallstones to create. So sometimes you can get those gallstones within the gallbladder, and they can start causing issues as well with pain.
It's wild how much the diet really has an impact on us.
Absolutely. And I cannot overemphasize, there's a lot of times when patients will first come in, especially on the first meeting, one of the first things that I'm always going to recommend a first visit with a patient is say, hey, let's start taking an objective look at our diet. Let's start considering things like a food log and a symptom log, and let's start tracking and trending what symptoms are occurring with certain foods, because a lot of times we can track and trend and narrow it down to maybe a single food group or 5 or 6 food items that, hey, every single time I eat X, Y, or Z, I'm having these symptoms. And then we try to pull back and either eliminate those things or eat them in moderation, because certainly, as I said before, the food can certainly dictate or cause certain symptoms that you're having. If you can remove those things, a lot of times those symptoms will maybe not completely disappear, but will certainly improve.
If you have eaten bad most of your life, or at least eaten bad on the weekend most of your life, can you, if you stop that, if you change your diet totally, get more sleep, if you start going on walks every day, can you literally change and redirect your life in a lot of ways? I mean, can you heal and recover as far as your body goes?
Absolutely. What I tell everyone when I'm talking to them is kind of the idea of the 90-10 rule. 90% of the time we're going to do what we're supposed to do, but 10% of the time we may splurge, right? 10% of the time, 90% of the time we're going to avoid, let's say, ice cream, but 10% of the time on the weekend, it's okay to eat ice cream, right? So we don't ever expect anyone to be perfect from a dietary perspective 100% of the time, because that's not possible. We're going to go to gatherings where they have cake. We're going to go to a restaurant where they have our favorite dessert. And we want people to absolutely be able to enjoy their life, to be able to eat those favorite foods, to have fun on holidays and eat grandma's pie, things like that. We don't want to say you can never do those things. But if we would take that perspective and say 10% of the time I'm going to do these things, but 90% of the time or 80% of the time, whatever it's going to be, I'm going to try to follow the best possible diet for myself. Absolutely. You can start seeing healing. There's a big topic right now in medicine is inflammation. And there's a lot of inflammation that can be caused by certain foods that we're consuming if we're intolerant to them, or that they're just processed or have various chemicals and things like that. They can cause a certain level of inflammation. If we can stop consuming those things that are causing us to flare, then we absolutely can see healing. It takes time. Nothing happens overnight. We generally tell people that it's going to take about 4 to 6 weeks before you start to see those noticeable improvements. But if you're willing to give it time, you absolutely can start to see healing and improvement in symptoms.
Here's another question. It says, I was diagnosed with diverticulitis about a year or two ago, and the doctor said, stop eating nuts for one. That was one of, I guess, on the food group not to eat. What exactly will nuts do?
That's a great question. So first you have to establish and differentiate between diverticulosis and diverticulitis. Diverticulosis are the little pockets that can form in your colon. That is what diverticulosis is, just small pockets that form in the colon. They're going to put you at a risk for diverticulitis. Diverticulitis is the acute flare of diverticulosis. Anytime you hear that itis there, inflammation, infection. So it is actually suggested that about 50 to 60% of people greater than age 50 have some form of diverticulosis. It's a relatively common finding, especially on colonoscopy and CT scans. But when it turns into that diverticulitis is when you have that infection and inflammation. It's an acute process that can be treated with antibiotics at times, various other treatments. So the question is, what can peanuts do? What can cause that? So when you think about peanuts or small seeds, anything that breaks down into a small particle and doesn't get completely processed, those can actually find their ways into those diverticulosis or diverticuli, those small pockets. And if they stay there for too long, for lack of better words, they can start to fester and cause inflammation, infection. And that is when you go from that diverticulosis picture to the diverticulitis picture. Diverticulosis is completely asymptomatic. You're not going to have symptoms from that. But then if you transition to that diverticulitis, that acute phase, that's when you're going to start seeing that abdominal pain. So the process there is that a lot of times people will be told to avoid those certain trigger foods. So foods with seeds, foods with nuts, things like that. Most recent data suggests that the most important thing for diverticulosis is a high fiber diet. So we would encourage all of our patients to consume a high fiber diet. And then from that perspective, consuming things in moderation and avoiding those that are known triggers. For example, for this individual, every time he eats peanuts, it may lead to a diverticulitis flare. So in that case, absolutely avoid peanuts. But if you're consuming a high fiber diet, then from that perspective, we say let's consume things in moderation. Again, food and symptom log. If it's causing issues, let's avoid it. If we can consume in moderation safely, then that's worth considering.
I've heard people say before, I'm having a diverticulitis flare. Is that real painful? What does it feel like?
It is absolutely painful. I have a background in emergency medicine as well. I worked in the ER for 6 years, so I saw people in very acute flares, and it can range anywhere from a mild to moderate discomfort to a severe and extreme pain. There are some complications that can arise from diverticulitis, like abscess. There is a chance of perforation. So it is a serious condition that needs to be evaluated by a healthcare provider. We're happy to evaluate those anytime. Generally, what we recommend is that you go in to see your healthcare provider for diagnostic testing. And then if it's your first diverticulitis flare or it's one of several in a row, we're going to recommend a colonoscopy 6 weeks later to further investigate to make sure that there's no other underlying causes for those flares.
Again, Peyton Pruitt with us this morning from MMC. He is a nurse practitioner there. We're going to take a short break and then we will be right back. Again, our phone number is 615-893-1450. Again, we'll be right back.
The Action Line on FM 101.9 and AM 1450 Murfreesboro, FM 100.5 Smyrna. Listen and watch at WGNSradio.com.
Your 401k is likely one of your most important assets, but it's only one part of a comprehensive retirement strategy. Edward Jones can help you understand how your retirement assets fit into your entire retirement picture so that you can work toward meeting your unique retirement goals. contact me, Lee Colvin, your Edward Jones Financial Advisor, in the Public Shopping Center on South Rutherford Boulevard, or give us a call at 615-907-7056. Edward Jones, Making Sense of Investing, member SIPC.
Broadcasting from the Middle Tennessee Electric Studios, MTE has provided light, comfort, and connection to our community since 1936. As your trusted energy advisor, MTE is always here to help. Connect online or download the MyMTE app.
Hi, this is Dan at Music World and Drummer's Den. If you need music gear, Music World and Drummer's Den is where you need to be. We have more guitars than anybody in town. We have all stringed instruments. We've got it all. We have keyboards as well. Do we have drums? We are Music World and Drummer's Den. We also have an excellent choice of used equipment. We are Music World and Drummer's Den, 2762 South Church Street, across from Indian Hills Golf Course.
Hi, this is Peter Demas. One of the things that we've done years ago is we've been able to do our orders, like our pastas and many other items, that we used to be able to put them in large pans, and now we have a catering team that will even deliver it to your home. We can drop it off for you, set it up, or they can come in and pick it up. Look up our catering menu on www.demasrestaurants.com. This is Peter Demas at Demas's Restaurant, 1115 Northwest Broad Street in Murfreesboro.
In today's changing world, you need a financial planner that you're comfortable with. Rely on the bonds that you've built with trusted friends at Old National Bank on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard here in the borough. And if you just moved here, visit us and enjoy warm, homemade cookies.
Honey, the cookies are ready.
Like Grandma used to make. Old National Bank. We're better together.
2230 Dr. MLK Jr. Boulevard. Old National Bank. Member FDIC.
The Action Line on FM 101.9 and AM 1450 Murfreesboro, FM 100.5 Smyrna. Listen and watch at WGNSradio.com.
This morning from Murfreesboro Medical Clinic, we have Peyton Pruitt, a nurse practitioner, and he is in the gastroenterology department. Again, we've been talking about just different things involving, I guess, that whole area of the stomach and up to the throat or so. What area, again, does all of that cover?
Great question. So a lot of times we do have people ask, what exactly do you guys see? What do you treat? So we will see and treat problems, disorders, diseases of the esophagus, the stomach, the small intestine or small bowel, the large intestine or colon, all the way down to the rectum. We will also see patients who have issues or concerns related to their gallbladder, their liver, their pancreas. We're happy to see pretty much if it's encased within the abdominal cavity. We are happy to see it, happy to treat it, and happy to further investigate any symptoms that you might be having.
Now, I know one of the things that you enjoy and have enjoyed in your free time are doing mission trips, both medical mission trips and non-medical as well. But when you go on mission trips, because there's a lot of folks in this area that do, what should you prepare for as far as the food you're going to eat?
Sure. A huge concern when traveling abroad is going to be potential food contamination from E. coli, things like that. So one of the most important things that you always want to think about is, first of all, from your health perspective, is washing your hands really well and picking restaurants or food production that is going to also follow those same standards of hand washing, follow those same standards of cleaning their food and preparing their food to those highest standards to make sure that there's no foodborne contaminants, because that is a common concern when people travel, is kind of either the traveler diarrhea that they can experience or just that foodborne, the food poisoning, if you will, from a foodborne pathogen. So always picking places that are going to be safe and clean, but also just making sure that you're doing your part as well and washing your hands. And that's a health practice across the board that we all just need to make sure that we're washing our hands. It's cold and flu season. So just a big added there to make sure you're washing your hands regularly.
Now, where are some of the areas that you've gone for this mission work?
Sure. So I've been to Cusco, Peru, in South America. We've done medical campaigns three different times down there. Always very exciting to go into South America. I've been to the Dominican Republic, and then I've been to various areas in Mexico. Unfortunately, as most things did, things have kind of slowed down from that perspective post-COVID. But we are hopeful as we get farther away from that, those things will be able to pick up and we'll be able to do those more often.
In places like the Dominican, for example, depending on where you are there, there are a lot of diseases that run pretty rampant. So I could see where it would be a little alarming or scary for somebody to be there when it comes to diet, because you don't have as many choices.
Absolutely. Biggest thing from that perspective is trying to find those stands, those restaurants, those grocery stores that are going to promote the cleanliness. And you can generally tell that when you walk in, how they prepare things, how they present things. Generally speaking, you can also do some things preventatively. I mentioned earlier, it's important to prevent. And so I always recommend, before you travel, if it's the first time you've traveled or you're going to be traveling somewhere new, to go and to discuss with primary care providers about potentially vaccines or medicine that you can have on hand or take preventatively to prevent any of those potential illnesses. Some practices even offer a specific travel doctor, and you could talk to a travel doctor specifically, and they can pull up the area in which you're going. They'll say, hey, based on the location that you're going to be, here are the recommendations that we have that you do before you travel.
You know, I hear from people every once in a while, I had, you know, fill in the blank, whatever surgery it was a number of years ago, and it makes it to where I'm scared to travel. And one person I know, they said something about having, the bigger part of their colon removed, and it has left them in fear of pretty much leaving Tennessee. So that said, what are things that we could do if you're one of those folks who had a surgery like that?
Sure. I think the greatest thing that you can do from that perspective is to consult with your healthcare provider. And like I said, don't be embarrassed to talk about those things. Ask those questions. Say, hey, listen, I'm thinking about traveling. What are some specific things that I can do? Or do you have any recommendations based on my specific condition? It's hard to make a broad recommendation based on the variety of surgeries and health conditions that people can have. But certainly that's what we are there for as healthcare providers, to provide that reassurance, to provide that counseling and teaching, and work working through and talking through some of those things. Some things, depending on the surgery, may say, hey, listen, you know, you're good to go. There's nothing specific that you have to do that the general population doesn't have to do. But there may be also things that people come to us and we're like, hey, listen, based on this particular condition, we're going to make these couple recommendations before you travel. And then also while you're traveling, going to make these recommendations just to promote your health as well as possible. You know, something that I always suggest, I've had this question before with patients, is if you have a relatively limited diet and you can only eat certain things, plan on taking certain things as far as food with you. Keep in mind, when you travel, obviously if you're in your car, you can bring anything that you want, but if you're traveling via airplane, for example, you can put things, you can check food, certain food items. You can't check liquid, things like that, unless it's a certain size, but as far as snacks and things like that, there are regulations that allow you to do that. So feel free that if you think, hey, I need to take certain food with me, if it's prepackaged, things like that, you absolutely can travel with that. And the TSA has a lot of guidelines that you can check as far as what can you take and what can you not take from a dietary perspective to promote your health.
When it comes to setting an appointment in your office particular, do folks need to be referred by their general practitioner doctor, or can they just call up and say, hey, I would like to be seen?
You do not have to have a referral to be seen within our gastroenterology office. The small caveat to that is that your insurance may require a referral. So that would be the only caveat there, but we do not require a referral. You can call, as I mentioned before, 615-867-8070, or go online at mmclinic.com and request an appointment. And someone will be happy to work you through that process. Once they look at the insurance information, they may have to say, hey, listen, based on this insurance, it does require a referral, but for the general population speaking, we do not require a referral. You can call and schedule an appointment.
As you meet with patients each day, is there a diagnosis or maybe a symptom that is more often than not one that people present or one that people tell you about?
Very, very common symptoms that I see every single day are things like gastric reflux or heartburn. We see a lot of that based on diet. We also see a lot of bloating, cramping, diarrhea, constipation. The one that people most frequently do not like to talk about is if they're having blood in their stool, but we want to see you. If you're having blood in your stool, we want to see you in clinic. You should be seen. And so, again, the most common ones are reflux, abdominal pain, diarrhea, constipation, abdominal bloating is a big one, and we're happy to see anything across the board. And again, there's nothing to be embarrassed about or ashamed of. I tell people every single day that I do this every day. I listen to it every day, and I want people to be, you know, comfortable with sharing their symptoms with us so we can help them.
And finding blood in the stool, that's one of those things that happens that I'm sure scares a lot of people to death, but in reality, probably what the better part of those people who come in, it's not a serious problem usually, right? I say that, but I don't work there. I don't. Sure. I'm not a doctor.
Across the board, I would be cautious to say not a serious problem, because I really don't know that until we further investigate. We have a conversation. We talk about frequency. We talk about how long has this been going on? When does this happen? Are you having associated symptoms? So I wouldn't. I don't think it would be fair for me to say it, you know, it's never a serious problem, because there are oftentimes that it is a serious problem. It's one that I would say a lot of times people put off for months before they will go be seen about this. So instead of putting it off for months and worrying over it, schedule that appointment, come in, and then we can talk about, hey, is this something that sounds serious and we need to further pursue? Or hey, you know, this may be a minor condition, let's treat it conservatively, and then we'll have you come back and see how your symptoms are progressing. So it's really hard to answer the question as far as acuity and severity until we've had that office visit. So don't delay it. Don't be embarrassed about it. Come talk to us and we can figure out where to go from there.
And what are some of the more common reasons as to why you would have that?
When you look at rectal bleeding, the sources in medicine, we would call those differentials. What are the differentials of what can cause rectal bleeding? That could be anything from a hemorrhoid to a fissure, which is a kind of a small tearing within the rectal wall, if you will. There could be some polyps that bleed. There could be diverticula that bleed. There could be colorectal cancer that is causing that bleeding. So until, again, we know how long has this been going on, how much blood are we talking about, when are we seeing the blood, what type of blood are we seeing, is it bright red blood, dark red, is it dark tarry, things like that, until we know the true specifics of the condition, it's hard to say exactly what the source is, but those are the common sources.
And again, Peyton Pruitt with us this morning, nurse practitioner with MMC. We talked about diet and how diet can really help somebody, or it could make you or break you, I guess. But if you do change your diet and you start, like we said, walking every day, things like that, you said about 4 weeks to start noticing a difference. But doing those things, does it literally prolong your life?
I would say absolutely it does. And not just from gastrointestinal health perspective, we're talking across the board. A healthy diet and exercise is going to be fantastic for your cardiovascular health. It's going to help with cholesterol management. It's going to help prevent hypertension or high blood pressure. It's going to help keep things like diabetes at bay if you're eating appropriately and you're exercising. So across the board from head to toe, your overall health is going to be promoted, and ultimately, hopefully, your lifespan extended if you're going to follow a healthy diet and exercise, because the health benefits across the board are going to be a lasting. And again, the greatest thing that we can do for our bodies is to move and to make sure that we're putting healthy things in it.
I know one of the things you mentioned that goes bad in folks would be the gallbladder, after somebody texted in about having pain. With things like the gallbladder, changing a diet, does it truly help that?
It does, absolutely. Most of the time, depending on the severity, the exact condition of what's causing the gallbladder issues, most patients can identify specific triggers and say, hey, listen, I know that I need to avoid these certain lists of foods or this certain group, spicy, fatty, fried, things like that. Now, there are some conditions of the gallbladder that unfortunately, it just needs to come out. There are emergent conditions that can arise from gallbladder issues that require more of an emergency surgery. Majority of the surgeries from a gallbladder perspective can be completed on an outpatient perspective. And that's when, from that perspective, we are a gastroenterology group. We are not a surgery group, but we do have a general surgery department within MMC. So if we identify a gallbladder that we think needs to come out, then we can refer to our friends within MMC at general surgery. It's a pretty seamless process and gets you evaluated by one of our general surgeons within MMC to discuss having that gallbladder removed.
Sounds good. Again, Peyton Pruitt with us this morning, and we are already out of time, but thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us.
And if anybody would like to maybe set an appointment, they can do so by first visiting, I guess, MMC online, right?
Correct. mmclinic.com or 615-867-8070.
And all the phone numbers are there. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you very much.